Greetings. You're now listening to the most handsome and intellectually superior specimens on Earth. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Starts now.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time of day it is where you are. We hope that you're doing well. We're pleased to be able to bring you another episode of I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. My name is Fresh, and we're thankful that you decided to join us today. Before we get into this week's episode, I'd like to remind you that if you like what you hear, to please, please, please go to Apple Podcasts and rate our podcast and leave a comment or two. The podcast is now available on Google Play and Spotify, as well with more outlets to come in the future. You can also connect with us on our social media platforms. On Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at ICBW Podcast. That's at ICBW Podcast. Be sure to like, comment, subscribe, and follow. All that good stuff. You can also check us out on our website for previous episodes at ICBWPodcast.com. And again, we're picking random listeners on a weekly basis who leave comments, rate us on iTunes, or connect with us on social media and share our content. The winners will get a prize pack that includes one of our t-shirts and some other merchandise that I know you're going to love. Because as I always say, I will not send you shit that you can't use. So now, without further delay, let's get this thing rolling. I'd like to introduce my partner, who is a connoisseur of all things culture. He's my partner in podcast crime. Reg, what is the deal, player?
What's up, Fresh? Hadn't seen you since the last time I saw you, cuz.
Yeah, man. You know how it goes, man. I'm living, man.
Living large?
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, yes. Yeah. Living large.
Trying to do it.
Yeah, trying to do it, man. It's funny that you would say living large, man, because today we have a very special guest. This episode is going to be it's going to be about healthcare, man. And you know, we promised the audience and the listeners that we would have discussions like this, regarding our health and the situation surrounding that. So today we have a special guest. Her name is Michelle Morris. She's a nurse practitioner. She's a native of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Graduated from Chattanooga State Technical Community College in 2002 with an associate's degree in nursing, where she received the Mary Mahoney Nursing Award as an outstanding student. In 2012, she graduated with a BS and MS degree in nursing from Southern Adventist University. She graduated in the top of her class. She belongs to several state and national nursing associations in Tennessee, as well as the International Honor Society of Nursing. Prior to becoming a nurse practitioner, Michelle worked as a medical intensive care unit charge nurse, very stressful job, part-time house supervisor for 10 years, serving as a preceptor and a mentor to new nurses. For the last several years, she's been practicing as an adult nurse practitioner with a large multi-special medical group in the local area, treating individuals from ages 13 and up. She recently joined a solo practice in hopes of being able to help build this practice among the African-American community to decrease incidence of disease. She treats acute and chronic medical conditions, including but not limited to hypertension, diabetes, asthma, depression, insomnia, anxiety, COPD, and thyroid disease, all the way up to the common cold, flu, viral illnesses. In addition, she performs annual physical exams and sports exams. Clinically, her interests include prevention and health maintenance, as well as making sure her patients are educated and informed about their health so they can make better choices. Personally, she enjoys giving back to the community, mentoring, empowering young girls, and being equipped to become strong women through education and collaboration. And she loves spending time with her family and friends. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for Michelle Morris. What's going on, Michelle?
Nothing much, fellas. Nothing much. How are you all doing?
Hey, we're doing pretty good. We're doing pretty good. And we are honored to have you on the show today to sprinkle us with a little bit of your medical expertise. Because we know as a Black community, we know we definitely need it. So we're going to talk about a few things today and, give you the opportunity, to kind of educate us and inform us and move us in the right direction as far as healthcare goes. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to let Red start off with the questions today.
Hi, Michelle. We're so glad to have you with us. But tell us why you're so passionate about health care.
Well, I've been a servant in some form all my life. I was raised by my grandmother, who was a little older when I was born. So I was always helping others, so to speak. She was the kind of person that always led her homeopathic ideals to other women. So that kind of gave me an idea of what I wanted to become as I went on through life. But I've been in the medical field for a little bit over 27 years. Going through the medical field, you know, you read research in class, and statistics only present a small part of the story of society and their health. But actual experience in working with the Black community, you learn that disease and death give you a chance to consider differences that exist among the ethnic backgrounds, and that allow areas of recommendations for potential change. And then you also have the personal aspect of it. My father passed away at the age of 52 from complications related to diabetes. Diabetes is an easily manageable disease, but yet Black people are affected by that disproportionately than white Americans. So for those reasons and a few more, my purpose has become my passion, and that's why I am so passionate about the healthcare field.
Well, that's good. And, you know, we can definitely hear it in your voice that you're definitely passionate about it. Let's get a little bit deeper into the discussion, because I know you have a lot of great information that you want to share with the listeners. But let's first talk about, you know, in our community, especially during the political cycle, access to healthcare, and I'm putting that in air quotes there if you could see me, is a catchphrase that is spoken frequently to get the attention of constituents and, you know, to get votes and things like that. Can you explain as a practitioner the actual definition of access to healthcare and why our access within the Black community is kind of hit or miss?
You are correct, Fresh, when you say access to healthcare is a catchphrase, but I don't think people are picking up on that in the Black community, and that's why I think it needs to be addressed that way. To some people, access could mean a lot of things. Do you have a healthcare facility or provider that makes available specific services that address your needs? Does it mean that being physically close to a clinic or hospital is within public transportation? But the government specifically defines access to health services as the timely use of personal health services to achieve the best outcomes. But that could mean a lot of different things in the Black community. As far as hit or miss, gaining entry into the healthcare system usually comes through health insurance coverage. We know that from research that there is a lack of insurance coverage in the Black community. If you do have insurance coverage, there could also be poor coverage. I give you an example. When I worked for a large healthcare medical practice, they oversaw their own insurance entity, but I had a $10,000 deductible. You know, to some people, that's quite a bit of money, and I'm paying over $400 every 2 weeks for healthcare coverage. But yet I still have to meet a $10,000 deductible first before they even pay 80% of my medical bills.
Wow.
So, you know, that's still quite a bit of money.
That is a lot of money. That's a lot of money.
And then they give you, they charge you for the insurance, but they'll give you 30%, a 30% discount if you see one of their providers. Well, they're dipping back into my pocket again. You know, what if I don't want, you know, they're limiting my access,
right,
so to speak.
Right.
So that's an issue. Again, accessing a location where needed healthcare services are provided. Are we geographically available? as I said before, African Americans or black people are hit with disproportionately with some medical conditions that affect us more than white people. We're not located, you don't find primary care providers located in low income areas. So in order, if I do work, that means I have to take off an hour early to get to my doctor's appointment, lose an hour worth of time, you know, sit there for 2 hours to be waited on, you know, so some of that matters. And then last but not least, that's very important, is finding a healthcare provider whom the patient trusts and communicate with. So personal relationships and culturally competence is very important. And I have seen that a lot more so in the last 5 years than I've ever seen.
So with when you talk about cultural competence, do you mean that just the physicians being able to just basically relate to their patients?
Well, it's like in any relationship, you know, trust is not only a foundation element to a therapeutic doctor-patient relationship, but it's also a vital factor in a patient's decision-making to seek help early before diseases advance. So, you know, it goes back to history. When you think about it, you know, the Tuskegee experiment, you know, that's what I'm talking about, culturally competent.
Okay.
You know, there's a distrust in the lack of providers, you know, the medical providers with the patients. They don't understand black people. You know, they're not culturally competent. They don't understand our plight sometimes, so to speak. Sometimes they're nonverbal cues. They communicate sometimes entirely different. You know, they have closed posture. They have their arms crossed or their hands in their pocket. And these are things that patients will tell me. These are things that I've personally seen going to the doctor with my grandmother. You know, sometimes they stand far away from you, and sometimes they don't even touch you.
Wow. That's amazing that actually would even exist. And I could definitely see how that would create some mistrust amongst patients, you know, towards practitioners and physicians as well. Rich has another question for you.
What do you think can be done to increase the accessibility of healthcare in our community?
I think we need to start locally and have the representatives be more accountable, generate more public awareness about what's going on to improve health care for minorities, eliminate the inequalities through change in public policy. It's not just enough to register to vote, but you got to go out and vote. I also think that we need to prioritize access to quality, affordable health care. Obama administration did well when he did the Affordable Health Care Act. But then we know that the Supreme Court ruled in 2012 that it was up to each individual state. And Southern conservative governors were concerned about the cost, and they opposed the expansion of the Affordable Health Care Act.
Right.
And, of course, that affected many of the black population. So 7 out of 10 states with the highest black population chose not to expand the Medicaid program. And what did that do? They left half of the people who are now unable to access affordable health care are people of color. So we need to make it more affordable. We need to be more accessible. We need to have more, we need to maybe offer incentives for primary care providers to be in low-income areas. We need to reduce the wait times. We also understand that people are saying our employment rate is low, but what about the pay? You know, that factors into healthcare because poverty is, the higher the poverty rate, the poorer the healthcare of that person is.
Right.
Offer incentives to healthcare members to do preventative exams. There are many times when I see patients, for women, you get a free mammogram over 40 every year. You get a free pap smear every year. You get a free wellness exam for men and women. People, even if you don't go to the doctor, go at least once a year. That's free. It's free.
Is that a Tennessee statute, or is that something that's federal?
I mean, that's nationwide with most. I accept most insurances like Cigna, Blue Cross, okay. Aetna. I mean, all those things are universal.
All right, so it's insurance based, basically. So
right.
Okay. All right, I got you. Okay.
So you know, educate those people. You know, I mean, we've been liberated, not for a long time, but we are now. You know, so long time ago, people were dying for black people to sit on the front of the bus. Where you find all the black kids now? On the back of the bus.
Right.
They were dying for us to go to school. What are black kids doing now? Skipping school. I mean, it's the same thing with your health care. I mean, we need to hold them accountable. When I was in school, when I grew up in an urban area, they used to come get us from school. Our parents used to sign little forms and come get us from school and take us to the dentist to get our teeth cleaned. You know, they no longer do that.
Right.
You know, and that leads to a lot of infection and other diseases in the body.
Right. So
I think we take our health for granted because nothing is happening now. We're not thinking 3, 4, 5 years down the line.
Right. And you know, we're not even thinking about it, especially, you know, when you're in your 20s. You're not really thinking about what my life or what my health condition is going to be like in my 40s or in my 50s. So,
right.
So I guess with as far as increasing, you know, the knowledge or even making preventative health care, you know, paramount, we probably need to start in grade school.
I agree. Even with, you know, on the job, there are single family parents that are men and women. Allow them flex time at work so that they can go to the doctor. Right. You know, and I think doctors also need to be more aware and held accountable for how much time you spend with the patient. You know, if you educate your patients and let them know it's okay to Google some things and ask me questions, but you also got to have the big picture. You know, go in there with your questions. You need to ask your doctor questions, and if they can't answer those questions or come up with the answer, then you need to find somebody else. You know,
right.
Don't just settle for I don't know and I'm going on out the door.
Right. Well, where you were mentioning, you know, about the onset of disease based on you know, lack of treatment. What are some of the health issues that our, you know, that our community faces, and why are the occurrences of these conditions increasing instead of decreasing? Although our knowledge base about all of these conditions has seems to have broadened over the years.
So the number one cause of death for all males and females is heart disease. And heart disease essentially makes a number of things, such as hypertension can lead to heart disease, diabetes can lead to heart disease, high cholesterol, which is plaque buildup in the arteries, can lead to heart disease. And part of that, again, goes back to the mistrust in the medical community. They're not seeking care early in life. They're not getting those preventative exams where you can find hypertension. Or if they put you on medication, if you go to your provider and you're diagnosed with hypertension, they're worried about the side effects of medicine. They don't teach you the lifestyle. They don't give you a chance or teach you or talk to you about the lifestyle changes you can make, such as if you're considered obese, let's work on your diet. Let's work on weight loss. You know, what about your stress level? You know, back in the day, they used to tell you stress can kill you, but indirectly, it can. You know, are you sleeping well? They don't take the time to ask you those questions. They just want to throw a pill at you and say, hey, come back and see me in 3 months. You know, and even with that, diabetes, by the time we diagnose people with diabetes, research says that they've been having diabetes for 3 to 5 years.
Wow.
And partly because they don't come to the doctor or they overutilize the emergency room for urgent issues instead of finding a primary care provider that they can trust,
right,
who they believe in, that's going to give them good care.
So,
and some medicines that we put people on are expensive. You know, am I going to buy my meal today? Am I going to pay my lights or am I going to get my medicine?
Right.
And if you don't trust your provider, then you don't communicate that to them very well that, hey, this medicine is too high. You know, can you help me? Is it something else that you can put me on?
Right.
You know, It takes a little more time, but in the end, it's worth it.
Now, you were saying before that that diabetes was a very treatable type disease, but if you have someone that that has had the disease and it's gone unchecked and untreated, you know, for 3 to 5 years, what type of challenge does that present, you know, to a physician or a practitioner who's treating the patient? How does that affect your treatment plan?
Well, first of all, the way that I would treat it is, first of all, gaining the patient trust, I would have a conversation with them and ask them, what do you know about this condition? Most of the time, someone in their family has it, or they have a friend that has it, or they've seen commercials on TV about diabetes. So you start with education. You find out where they are, you know. And most people, it's a lifestyle. So you don't expect them to change overnight. And I'm one of the providers that believes everything in moderation. You know, you can have a cupcake. We don't have a cupcake every day. So we talk about what can you do. You pick 5 things that you need to work on, and you pick the number one thing you should work on should be the easiest thing that you can change. So if it's walking 30 minutes 3 times a day, that's the easiest thing that you can change, then let's make that your number one. And when you master that, you move on to number two. But they have to be, it has to be a collaboration between you and the patient. Sometimes you have to let the patient direct the plan of care, because that's when they're going to be most agreeable to it. You know, you're going to get the least resistance. It's not going to be, oh, I'm going to give you this shot. You know, you ask them, how do they feel about injections? You know, are you going to be compliant with giving yourself an injection? If they're not, then don't start there. Even though your textbook may tell you, or your guidelines may say, if your A1C is this, then you start out with an injection. It's not going to matter if they're not going to be compliant, if they don't believe in giving themselves shots.
Right, right.
You just don't do that. You treat each person individually, and you find providers that don't do that. So I would find out a little bit more about the patient if they're new to me. Truck drivers are hard to treat. I just had a truck driver that I diagnosed with diabetes last week. They're very hard to treat because they're on the go all the time. So their lifestyle is very hard. It's hard to get them to come in and see you. So you know what I do? When they come in town, I tell them, tell me when you're coming in, even on my off day, or I stay late, just to make sure that you're going to get good care. So sometimes you have to come out of your realm or come out of the normal just to make sure that this person is going to be okay. And they'll remember that.
Right.
You know, you want them to continue to be healthy, not just get healthy, but continue to be healthy.
And I'm sure that makes a difference as far as being able to convince patients to follow your instructions a little bit more closely. You know, once you gain that trust and you show that you're willing to, you know, take a little bit of your personal time to be sure that they get the best care possible. And I wanted to ask you, you know, again about the prevalence of these conditions still within the Black community. Why do you think? You know, because there's so much information out there now, especially with, you know, with search engines and YouTube and things like that. I mean, the information is out there that patients could, you know, read, you know, on their own. You know, even if you don't have the internet at home, but you don't have a cell phone. I mean, the libraries and things like that. I mean, the knowledge is just out there and it's more accessible than ever. Why is the frequency of these diseases increasing? Do you have any thoughts on that? Why are the percentages still going up?
Personally, I think the knowledge is there, but a lot of people don't adhere to the knowledge. You know, as I said before, because you're not affected by it, we mentioned hypertension. They call hypertension the silent killer. You can walk around with high blood pressure and not even know it. You know, you feel like you're not being affected by it, so you're okay. Some people may start medication and have side effects and don't want to take that medication and then don't communicate to their provider that they're having side effects, and they just stop the medicine. And they say, well, I'm fine, nothing's wrong, you know, and don't go back to see that provider. Some people don't take the time to become educated. Some providers don't take the time to educate their patients. Our lifestyle plays a big part in it. We don't want to change. We've been living this way all our lives, so change is hard. People are resistant to change. So I think that plays a lot in it. Everyday stress, you know, like I said before, our lifestyle. And change doesn't happen overnight. So, I think if we offer better access to health care, become better providers, listen to the patient as well, and not just go in there with the I'm right kind of attitude and you need to listen to me because I know what I'm talking about, I think we'll do better, you know, as far as helping people of color take a lead or become, for lack of a better word, become more involved in their health care.
Okay. I got you.
Michelle, you know, I like your approach to those answers. It seems to resonate very well, especially when you're talking about the Black community. There's been a lot of talk about the mortality rate of Black women when it comes to childbirth. What conditions would lead to our women dying at such a high rate? And what can be done to decrease the mortality rate?
Well, we do know, once again, that Black women die 3 to 4 times. They're more likely 3 to 4 times to die than a white woman from childbirth. And it is kind of sad because we're one of the more industrialized countries, and yet we're still dying when we're giving birth. That's kind of astounding to me, especially as a woman. And in the medical field, you know, in each, probably in all employments, there are some terms or words that you all use. And in the healthcare field, we always say giving birth is close to dying without death, without dying. So let me first define what mortality would mean in pregnancy. So to us, a pregnancy-related death is defined as a death of a woman during or within a year of pregnancy that is either caused by complications from the pregnancy or a chain of events initiated by the pregnancy or the aggravation of an unrelated condition. It goes back to most or many pregnant women have chronic health conditions, which we have discussed earlier, such as hypertension, diabetes, obesity, and that is compiled with being pregnant, which increases your risk for adverse outcomes. Some women have mental illness. You find people with mental illness more than likely have a comorbidity of substance abuse. They develop chronic diseases. They have poor health because their lack of consistency in providing health care for themselves is poor because of their mental illness. A lot of women are having babies at a later age in life, and a lot of women are not seeking prenatal care. We all know that smoking can increase the risk factors for adverse outcomes and illicit drug use. So those are several reasons or conditions that cause such a high rate, but also it goes back to history. Painful experiments on slaves for medical science was done back in the day, particularly J. Marion Sims, who's also known as the father of modern gynecology. Have you all heard of him?
Yes.
Right. So a lot of people in my field, when I talk about him, have never heard of him. They don't teach that in school. They don't educate us about those kind of things. And so, you know, he did a lot of experimental procedures on enslaved women, particularly one woman that was a 17-year-old slave. He performed 30 operations on her, especially without using anesthesia. There are leading causes to women dying with giving childbirth. And recently we had a well-known figure, Serena Williams, who had what we would call an embolism, which is a clot after giving birth, and this is public knowledge, so I'm not divulging any information. But she made light to the situation. She had to have a cesarean section and ended up with an embolism. She went to the emergency room on several occasions initially, and no one would. She was complaining of pain, and their response was she had just had a cesarean section. Pain was normal. Well, after they did a thorough investigation or did more, I'm sorry, more testing, they found out that she did have an embolism, admitted her and treated her. It goes to show that regardless of the quality of health insurance that you have, sometimes, or even the ability to pay for care, sometimes they just don't believe us. And that's a good question to ask, why? You know, pain is subjective. It is what you say it is. You know, and it's not always a definitive or a cause that's right there in your face that you can give for that. Fortunately, that they have reduced the incidence of mortality due to hemorrhage and embolism, but it has increased due to heart disease, which I had mentioned earlier about hypertension and infection. When these people go to give you, to numb you, so to speak, to so that you can have this baby, you need to make sure your anesthesiologist has a mask on, because they're introducing these drugs into your spinal fluid, you know, into your spinal canal. I had a patient that I had in the intensive care unit because the anesthesiologist forgot to put a mask on. This patient ended up with meningitis. Wow. And that's where it came from. Wow. Yeah. Also, you know, in 2009, there was a pandemic of the H1N1. I had a 24-year-old girl that gave, black female, that gave birth, never saw her baby a day in her life, and she ended up passing away. We ended up adopting her kids, my husband and I, adopting her kids for Christmas and giving them something every year. She never got immunized, but because of the flu, she died. She gave childbirth, she had the flu, got infection, became septic, got all over her body, and she died. But a little bit of education, somebody should have told that lady, if you never get it this time because you have another life inside of you.
Right, right.
You know, just talk to them. Explain it to them. Take the time to educate them. We know smoking can cause issues with pregnancy. You know, to ask them, okay, if you don't want to stop smoking, just stop smoking for a little while. You know, offer some kind of classes to these people, you know, during their pregnancy.
Right, right.
So I just think if we, you know, if we become more in tune with ourselves, we're, you know, it's not just up to me to help my children. It's up to me to help my neighbor. It's up to me to help the next person, because I want somebody to help my child. I want somebody to help my grandchildren, you know, my grandmother. You know, take the time to listen.
Right, right.
You know, it's very important. And I think the way that we can decrease the mortality rate is it always comes back to education. Be concerned. That one time that you talk to them may be the one time that they listen. You know, right. Make that interaction about stop smoking or making a healthy choice each time they come in the office. You know, sometimes it takes them 10 times to listen to it before it finally sinks in. But just take the time to say it. You know, be an example.
Let me ask you a really quick question, real quick, because we're about to close in a second. But would it be safe to say that you know, women in particular, should you be more mindful of your health when you're actually trying to conceive? And this is considering all things being equal. We're not talking about unexpected pregnancies or any of this. If you're planning to conceive, is it safe to say that you should be mindful of your health prior to even trying to conceive? I mean, you know, when you talk about prenatal care, is that what you're talking about? It's like you should be in relatively decent enough medical condition to even try to conceive? Is that something that you would agree with or not?
If you asked me that 30 years ago, I would have said no. But you asked me now, being more informed and educated, I would say yes. You know, you people think you just go in there, you get you have fun making a baby, you pop it out, and you go on. That's not the case anymore. You know, you should be more in tune with your health and understand what goes on with your body when you're, you know, when you're giving birth. There's a lot that goes on. There's a lot of bleeding that goes on. There, you know, there is a lot of change that happens to your body that goes on. And the doctor who, you know, who's there, they try to tell you when you're going to have your baby. Sometimes they don't let the natural process take its course. You know, they're so want you to be on their schedule. They'll tell you, well, you were supposed to have the baby. They count your days. It's 37 weeks. I'm going to induce your labor Saturday, you know. And then there's complications from the medicine that they give you to induce your labor instead of just letting nature take its course. You know, you listen to him and you don't research it, and you end up with complications.
Right.
So if you have hypertension, try to get your hypertension under control before you try to conceive. That is correct. If you have diabetes, you would definitely have gestational diabetes during pregnancy. You know, that will further complicate your issue. And there are only certain medicines we can put you on when you're pregnant because it affects your baby.
Right.
You know, if you have mental illness, there's only one medicine that we can use in people with mental illness when they're pregnant. There's only two medicines we can use in people with hypertension when they're pregnant.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, they're limited.
Right. Okay. So definitely, you know, preconception, healthcare, you know, getting yourself in the best condition possible to be able to carry a child for the duration of a pregnancy and have it be as safe as possible, if, you know, for lack of a better term. That is something that you definitely recommend.
That is something I definitely recommend. Yes, it is.
Right.
And so, you know, because you want to give that baby the best chance possible and yourself to be able to be born very healthy.
Right, right. All right. Well, hey, look, we really appreciate you taking the time out to lend a little bit of your expertise to us and our listening audience. You know, we promise to bring, you know, the audience from the beginning, you know, issues and solutions that are specific to us and our community, because we definitely care about the community. And we can definitely tell by the way that you're answering these questions and the detail that you're providing that you're definitely vested, you know, in healthcare and in our community as well. So we definitely appreciate you. And, you know, we hope that the patients that you serve in the community that you serve appreciates you as well, because you are definitely an asset to, you know, to both. So, you know, we appreciate your time today. And is there anything else that you want to leave us with?
Well, I want to thank you guys for giving me this platform to speak about health in the Black community. I understand that it's very important and I'm very passionate about it. But I also want to mark this disclaimer. You know, there are some people that are ignorant and some people who act ignorant. I know that we can't fix the entire world or the entire Black community. If we give them the information, some people do nothing with it. But once again, if we try to help each other and pull each other up and let them know that it is important, we don't have to beat them over the head with it. But every once in a while, let people know that you care, because after you've been oppressed for so long, you know, that little piece of light of hope sometimes make a difference, and say, you know what, you can beat that. You just have to want to. You know, I can't do it for you, but you got to want it for yourself. You know, so my thing is just to try to help and empower and encourage each other.
Well, all right. Well, hey, we definitely appreciate your time once again.
Be good, be safe, and behave.
All right, man. We out.
I could be wrong, but I doubt it. So don't enter this debate if you ain't about it. Reflection and introspect. Make sure that you come correct. Then you should probably hurry. It gets crowded. Bring a friend with you. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Don't enter this debate if you ain't about it. Reflection and introspect. Make sure that you come correct. Then you should hurry up. It might get crowded. Bring a friend with you. Expression Reds, their curators are cool. The culture and consciousness brought directly to you. Tune in every week for the newest of new and occasional politics as it pertains to you. Divergent point of views make for a whole picture. And we suggest you get your money up and take the shit.
shit with ya. Ain't no fountain to you, but it's a secret elixir to ensure the black man is a permanent fixture. Standing here in America behind enemy lines, where more often than not my skin's considered a crime. Cops kill us daily and will never do time, while a crooked ass judge decides the fate for mine. One day at a time is what my mama would say, and since mama said living ain't no time to play, and since I got a little game, I'ma give it away. But let's start the show before I get carried away. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. So don't enter this debate if you ain't bout it. Reflection and introspect, make sure that you come correct, then you should probably hurry, it gets crowded. Bring a friend with you. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Don't enter this debate if you ain't bout it. Reflection and introspect, make sure that you come correct, then you should hurry up, it might get crowded. Bring a friend with you. You just tuned in to I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It, hosted by Fresh and Reg. Holla back next week.